The second case for oral argument this morning is Rita Fix, appellant, versus the First State Bank of Roscoe, appellees. For the appellant, we have Mr. Lee Schoenbeck, an attorney from Watertown, South Dakota. And for the appellee bank, we have Mr. Roger Damgaard, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Schoenbeck, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning, Justices.
Clerk.
Appreciate this opportunity to appear before you. This is a historic case. When this case is reported, it will be the first reported decision where a jury in South Dakota found abuse of process. There is no reported decision in South Dakota where a jury has made that finding. This is the first. In this case, those findings, that special jury interrogatory, are not challenged about liability, that in fact the bank and the holding company conspired to abuse process. We raise before this court the issue of damages. There are six issues raised in by appellants on appeal. I would like to focus primarily on the issue of damages, which is the essence of what I believe this appeal is about. I love the study of law, and I think it's sort of like husking corn. I mean, you have to be willing to pull the layers back to get to the essence of the fruit. There's no shortcuts to it. When you look at the issue of mental anguish, in our case, the jury was instructed using the higher burden of intentional infliction of emotional distress. And that is a reaction, I believe a misreading, but a reaction to the Marriott decision and some of the language in Marriott.
Before you get into that, would you kind of go through the process of how did that abuse of process get before the court? Because when it was dismissed out of, the bankruptcy allowed you to proceed, it was intentional infliction of emotional distress. Then when you sued in state court, would you kind of go through the process?
Yes, thank you. And it is a little confusing because of what happened is we first filed in state court, I think there were five counts in that complaint. There was an injunction granted that took us into the bankruptcy realm, went through the bankruptcy court, appealed to the district court. Judge Korneman ruled for us and quashed the injunction.
But the abuse of process was not part of that original five.
That's correct. And then we amended the complaint, and so now there were nine counts and different parties in the amended complaint. So by the time the Eighth Circuit ruled, they weren't ruling on the counts that were proceeding in the state court litigation, because the state court litigation continued to proceed when Judge Korneman quashed the injunction.
I think you were going to tell us why Marriott doesn't control here.
Okay, thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you. And recognizing the court wrote Marriott.
I know where Eden is, too.
Pride and authorship. And those are it's a whole other story. Marriott, when you look at the decision, there's a couple of really important parts to the decision that I think are overlooked. First, Marriott relies on two authorities, and you have to always peel back the decision because we're a law of stare decisis and say, what was Marriott based on? You need to know that Marriott was a strict liability, a midnight banking rule violation. There was no finding of an intentional act by the plaintiffs, by the jury. There was no allegation, no finding of an intentional act. It was a negligent act, a malum prohibitum type statute. So Marriott relied on two authorities in South Dakota. One is the Stenny case. Stenny was a case where bad faith had been dismissed on summary judgment, and the only count they had to proceed on was intentional infliction of emotional distress. And so the court's talking about Stenny and says that in that one, you have to show the higher burden that goes with intentional infliction. And the other case mentioned in Marriott is the Wright case. And when you look at Wright was a situation that was a negligent infliction of emotional distress case. Wright relied upon the Chisholm case. And the real, when you peel all the husks back, where you're going to find the body of law in South Dakota, it's going to be the Chisholm decision. In the Chisholm decision, page 240, it's paragraphs 3 and 4 of that case, 283 Northwest 2nd, 235. It cites the Jacksonville, which Bank of Jacksonville is actually a South Dakota case, and a Minnesota decision. Both of them stand for the principle that when you have an intentional tort, and they even list some of them, slander, malicious prosecution, libel, when you have those, you use, because you have to prove the intentionalness of the act, you use a lower damage standard, which is the mental anguish standard. It's set out as black-letter rule of law in the Chisholm decision. If you don't have an intentional act on the liability side, then if it's mere negligence, the language from Wright cited by Marriott, if it's mere negligence, then you have a higher burden of proof on damages. Then you have to show the intentional infliction standard. Chisholm lays it out and says that's clearly the law. And they say the rule seems to be well established. And the law applicable to this case is summed up, and there they're citing the Minnesota decision. So Chisholm is where it starts. Along comes Wright. It tells us the same thing about Chisholm, but in Wright, it was a negligent infliction of emotional distress case, and they said, look, if you're going to have negligent infliction, then you have, because there's no proving of intentional acts on the liability side, then you have to hit the higher burden. And they expressed three policy concerns in Wright about why in a mere negligence case, you can't use that lower damage burden of emotional distress. Along comes Marriott. Marriott cites to Wright, and in fact, cites the three policy reasons from Wright about why you can't use the lower emotional distress damage burden in a mere negligence case. In fact, it says, when it lists those three policy reasons in Wright, or excuse me, in Marriott, it says, for a situation whose conduct was only negligent. There has never been a case in South Dakota that has ever ruled contrary to the Chisholm line of cases that when you have an intentional act, that you have to use a higher damage burden. And if you step back and think about why that would be the black letter rule of law, fortunately he died this past year, but if Professor Driscoll is still alive, I can still remember it from his lectures. The reason is because in negligence cases, we aren't saying that they've acted that bad. And so we make you prove higher damages because, like Wright, the language cited in Marriott, we don't want to have liability for people that are emotionally soft happening in situations where the conduct was mere negligence. And that's the policy language as Marriott cites from Wright. But think about where Chisholm comes from when you have somebody who has acted intentionally. These are the people that have abused the legal system, abuse of process, or done it with malicious prosecution, or slandered or libels. For those people, we use the emotional distress standard as is set out in the Chisholm case because it's a lower damage standard, but it's because their conduct is so bad they should be responsible for everything they did. In our case, it's conspiracy to abuse process. It is an intentional tort. We were not given the damage instruction of emotional distress, mental anguish, that is consistent with the Chisholm case. We asked for it, it was denied. We were given the higher burden of proof from an intentional infliction of emotional distress case. And that's why we're before this court, asking this court to consider reversing the special interrogatory as to damages.
So it wouldn't be extreme and disabling or whatever that term is. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. That's not the burden. That shouldn't be the burden of proof, according to Chisholm and that line of law in South Dakota, when you have an intentional tort.
Is there any difference between mental anguish and emotional distress? We use them interchangeably.
Justice, I don't think there's a difference. They're used interchangeably, and I keep catching myself doing it, and I've done it in front of you here today. I think the law uses those two terms interchangeably.
Fair enough. They're not words of art in the legal.
Well, they're your words of art used interchangeably.
Right.
It's the lawyers practicing medicine. If I might, the second issue that we've raised has to do with the damage offset argument, and this is just about a jury argument. We anticipated that a bank and the holding company were going to ask the jury possibly to offset the allegations of their losses against the damage claim suffered, where we thought it was pretty clear that the bank had abused process. And so we made a motion in limine and said, Judge, they're going to do this, and please don't let them do it. There's no offset here. How could there logically be an offset to abuse of process? And the trial judge overruled, allowed the argument. The argument is quoted verbatim in the briefs. It's verbatim from the record. The bank said, how can you award her $120,000 when we've got $200,000 of losses? They're asking them to offset it, and that's an improper argument. And we'd ask the court, if the court chooses to remand with respect to issue number one, to give direction on issue number two. The third issue.
Is there any indication the jury actually followed that?
Well, we do know from the special interrogatories that the jury found what I think people in the legal system would view as offensive conduct, abusing legal process, and awarded no damages. Now, they had a higher damage instruction, and I think that's the real issue that this court will decide whether or not to reverse on is going to be that. But if you do decide, we'd ask for guidance on that second issue. The third issue is a joint tortfeasor contribution issue that came up while the jury was out, and from the bench, the judge said that he was going to allow, if they returned a verdict, he was going to allow an offset of the one defendant settled out, the state's attorney, and allow that to be deducted from the compensatory damages to see if there would be any compensatory damages to go forward on a punitive damages, a bifurcated case. That's sort of taken HOAS, but it's taken it and misusing it. The joint tortfeasor contribution statute is in every one of the cases this court has handled, Deegan, Schick, Setliff, Freeman, all of them say, when the case is done against the one you're getting the verdict against, then that final number, you deduct the amount that you settled with. And that's a joint tortfeasor contribution. You don't pick out one part and say, I'm going to apply it all to compensatory damages. And the reason you wouldn't is because the settlement isn't just compensatory damages. It's all damages. And the offset under the joint tortfeasor contribution statute is against all damages, not one category of damages.
You know, your argument is logical, but when you look at the statute, what bothers me about the wording of the statute, it says reduces the claim against the other tortfeasors. It doesn't say reduces the judgment against the other tortfeasors.
Except all of the cases that have talked about it, Setliff and Freeman, for example, say the total claim. And they have, and every one of this court's prior decisions have looked at the judgment and the total claim in making the deduction. There isn't any logical reason to say we're going to take one, because otherwise, why not take punitive damages? Why pick one category of damages to offset a settlement against? The fourth issue is alternate juror selection. And again, this court isn't going to reverse this case based on that issue. I understand that. But it's an issue that if the court decides, it would be helpful for those of us in the practice to address. And I can't help but think that this court has had some other decisions when one member of the judiciary had a tendency to sort of write his own rules on procedure. Innovative, but a little bit outside of the standard rules. And this court has, when they've addressed those, well, I said, look, we've got a unified set of rules here. We're going to do it the way it's written. And this one isn't that egregious. I understand that. But we do have a system under the statute for that. And the statute says the last one in, the alternate replaces. It doesn't say last one, but the language, if you read it, the first statute is that you take out, they replace a juror, an alternate replaces a juror, which effectively makes them the last one in.
But does the statute also says by lot, and there's a comma after that before it goes on to the language you want to apply?
And Justice, there's a...
You're ignoring the comma?
Justice, there's a second stat. That's a second statute that provides an alternate way to do it, and it does say, it gives an example of by lot, and then it says... I don't have it in front of me verbatim, but it says the judge can do it any other way the parties agree. I think by lot is an example, but more importantly is the first statute is the one that sets the rule, and that's the alternate method in that second statute. And in a unified judicial system, a system of jury selection that would be the same trial across from Montana to Nebraska within the state of South Dakota, I think is the intent of the rules. And there is a rule that does that. And the alternate system says, gives an example of by lot, and it's got a comma, and then it says that the court can do it any way that the parties agree. That looks to be an alternative if the parties agree. There is a black letter rule way to do it in the first statute that's referenced in our brief. The fifth issue has to do with costs from a separate lawsuit, the bankruptcy proceeding. There was no application made by a bank or holding company for costs in the bankruptcy. In fact, it would be arguable about whether or not they were the prevailing party. It was a split decision. But then when the costs application came in the state court action, all of the costs for the Eighth Circuit appeal, all of those that would have been decided had they made an application in the federal proceeding, show up in an application in now this lawsuit. And this court in DeHaven versus Hall expressed caution. And it said, back, he said, use cautious restraint about going outside of those enumerated costs identified in the statute 15-17-37. And so we would encourage the court to consider whether costs from a separate lawsuit where a separate application could have been made, if in fact they would have been entitled to them, should have been added to this. And our last issue is the summary judgment issue with respect to intentional infliction of emotional distress, and we only ask the court to address it if they rule against us on the first issue. If the court reconsiders on the first issue, we're not asking to have an opportunity to retry the intention or to try the intentional infliction case. But in this case, the jury found that there was a conspiracy to abuse process. That's certainly on the liability side of an intentional act, seems to be way over the bar for a summary judgment standard, we think that we met the burden at the trial court level to beat summary judgment. We actually met it a couple times in prevailing on punitive damage, the ability to go forward on punitive damages against the defendants, and then at the last minute, or then late in the proceeding, that was dismissed. But again,
Didn't the Eighth Circuit, though, say that Fix didn't own that cause of action?
Well, excuse me, the Eighth Circuit said we did own that cause of action.
Well, okay, excuse me. The claim, though, was the wrongful sale of the house, not the abusive process, wasn't it?
Unintentional infliction, yes.
Yes.
Yes, because the abusive process was not before the Eighth Circuit, because it was in the amended complaint that wasn't taken up. You know, the Eighth Circuit decision is I suspect debtor-creditor lawyers and law professors could write treatises about that decision because of how they ruled on the intentional infliction. You will lose much hair trying to sort out what exactly they did, but here's one spin at it, at least. They had to split up those cause of action, say some belong to the trustee and some belong to Rita Fix. And for Rita Fix, they said she could pursue the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim related to the sale of her home. And I know that troubles the bank because they say, well, that's not right because the trustee owns the property claim for the loss of the home because of bankruptcy law. But the Eighth Circuit ruled the intentional infliction when they had to, not deciding the elements of the cause of action, but deciding ownership, they clearly said she owned the right for the intentional infliction for the wrongful sale of her home. The trustee owned the right to recover the proceeds for the wrongful sale of the home, an asset that should have been to the trustee. But the intentional infliction, that cause of action was her cause of action, and it was for the sale of the home. And that's the way the Eighth Circuit ruled, and that was the law of the case we lived with.
If we were to agree with you and send it back, are you anticipating we just send it back to be retried the entire thing?
I'm asking the court to, because there's a special interrogatory of which three of the questions are not challenged on this appeal, we'd ask the court to just send it back to retry the damage issue, which is the only part of the verdict that's subject to this appeal, that's been raised for review on this appeal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenbeck. Mr. Damgaard, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Good morning. Let's talk about damages. We know that before you get to damages, there has to be liability, and you need both. You can't just have liability. You have to prove damages as well to get damages. And here the record more than supports the fact that the jury came back and entered a verdict finding no damage. And in fact, if you look at the record, the evidence on damages was scant at best. The plaintiff's own medical expert said he didn't recall the plaintiff complaining about any mental distress relating to being prosecuted. And more importantly, the jury could have easily determined that perhaps if the plaintiff was experiencing some distress, it was distress that she was experiencing because she did wrong, she knew she did wrong, and she was rightfully charged with felonies for what she did do wrong. And beyond that, damages, of course, are uniquely within the realm of a jury.
But, Mr. Damgaard, isn't that all the more reason to give a correct jury instruction that doesn't require an even higher burden? I mean, this is a low factual showing here compared to some cases. But doesn't that highlight the need for a correct jury instruction? And I know you're going to argue it was correct, but...
It absolutely was correct, Your Honor. And the issue of what was the right legal standard, I believe, is controlled by Marriott. And Marriott recognized that courts are wary about emotional distress-related claims. and for good reason. And so what the court did is it established a uniform standard for all claims and causes of action that raise a portion of those damages based on emotional distress. So instead of having 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 standards, depending on what the cause of action was, the court said, let's have one, because we're concerned about this emotional distress argument, and establish one cause.
There are several statutes that allow for damages of mental anguish, and the legislature has established them. They start out as criminal, I think one's pornography or something like that, and it allows for a civil action and says damages for mental anguish. Are we saying that the legislature can't just use mental anguish, or that every time it does, it has to be extreme and disabling?
No, I think what the court, Mary, was doing is said that when you're dealing with mental anguish, when you're dealing with emotional distress, because of the nature of the damage that's being requested and the potential for abuse, that you have to come up with a standard that's more definitive than that. And so that's exactly what the court did in Marriott. So what it really did was supplement and give some detail to what may already be in those statutes. Those statutes are, that you're talking about, Justice Meyer-Henry, are pretty amorphous. So you need to say, what kind of standard are we going to use here? And so that clearly makes sense to me that that's what should happen under those circumstances. Now, one of the big issues that every jury faces in every case where it's determining facts is the credibility of the witnesses. Of course, this was an extremely important matter in this case. And here we have a plaintiff who stole money from the bank by selling grain that didn't belong to her. She did it not once or twice, but over a period of years. And she knew she had no grain. She knew it belonged to her son. She knew her son had a lien on that grain with the bank. She deposited the proceeds in a bank other than the First State Bank to avoid detection. She went in and picked up the checks at the elevator, and many of them weren't small. She signed underneath a bold endorsement representing that I own this grain and representing that there aren't any liens on it, when she knew that both those representations were untrue. And she ultimately kept a lot of money for herself and gave the rest to her son. And it doesn't end there.
But that isn't what this lawsuit is about, is it? That this is about intentional infliction of emotional distress and abuse of process. Now you're claiming that as an offset, but isn't this claim about abuse of process that the bank and the state's attorney conspired? Isn't that what the jury found, and isn't that what was pled?
The jury found that there had been a conspiracy to abuse process, but the jury found there were no damages. And damages is uniquely for the jury, and it's based in part on the credibility of the witnesses. Do you believe this woman when she says that she has been and suffered emotional distress because of what's happened? That's a credibility issue. The jury could look at what happened, and they could say, no, we don't believe what she has to say. And the jury was free to disregard any and all the testimony from any of her other witnesses regarding her emotional distress, and to come to the conclusion that she was emotionally distressed because she did wrong, and she knew she did wrong. And she got charged with felonies because she committed felonies. So damages come down to an issue of credibility, and it comes down to looking at all the evidence. My point here, there's plenty of evidence in the record for the jury to determine that there were no damages. And frankly, the sad story doesn't end there. She also raised her right hand and took an oath to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and then she sat there and she lied. One question after another, lied about stealing, and lied about disposing of the money. That goes to her credibility as well. So there's plenty of facts in this record for a jury to say, we don't think there's any damages here. We don't think she experienced any damages because of the abusive process. And that's uniquely a jury issue. Now, As long as we're on in the damage realm, I want to continue a little bit with the issue of the legal standard for emotional distress. Now, the Torres decision was cited by the appellants for the first time in their reply brief. It's a 2004 unpublished decision of the Federal District Court here in South Dakota. We obviously had not had an opportunity to respond to that because it wasn't addressed with the trial court, wasn't addressed in the opening brief of the appellant. But I think that case goes a long way to addressing this legal standard that's been discussed on this record and why it's important that to realize that Marriott is the controlling case. And there's no doubt that decisions by federal courts interpreting state law are not binding on this court or any other state court. And I think the district court missed its mark by simply relying on the Roth case. And the Roth case was 667 Northwest 2nd 651, decided in 2003, so it would have been several years after Marriott. And the problem is that Roth doesn't deal with what the legal standard should be for emotional distress. It's the sufficiency of the evidence case, and that's all it is. The standard is not even cited or addressed, and Marriott isn't even addressed. Now, if this court surely were going to reverse Marriott, they certainly would want to cite it in the decision doing that. And it simply just is no justification for the district court's conclusion. And the district court also ignores the Steen versus State Farm case, 583 Northwest 2nd 404. It's a 98 case. Not as explicit as Marriott, but certainly came to the conclusion that you need to apply the emotional distress standard. It makes sense to apply that standard. So what the district court ultimately ended up doing is it ended up doing what this court was trying to avoid in Marriott. And that's a situation where you have different causes of action, so we're going to use different standards for emotional distress. And for those reasons, I think that Torres should be rejected and doesn't make any sense.
How do you distinguish Chisholm? You know, especially the language that says, if it's willful, wanton, intentional acts such as malicious prosecution, which is a pretty close cousin to abuse of process.
Well, first of all, I believe Chisholm is isn't it a Minnesota case? No? Okay. Well, I think that, first of all, it's a prior case, number one. And, of course, they're free to, and often do, change their minds. They often do take a look at things and look at different issues and different policies. And the bottom line is that Marriott was decided after Chisholm, and Marriott recognizes we need a uniform standard. We don't need a different standard for every cause of action out there. It's important to have a single standard when we're dealing with something as amorphous as emotional distress damages. So what happened is the court took the bull by the horns in Marriott, recognized that, and articulated it very, very clearly. And it makes a lot of sense. I'd like to address the issue of the trial court granting summary judgment on the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim that arose from the alleged or from the selling of the plaintiff's prior home. Now, it's important to remember and to understand that the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals didn't decide the merits of any of these claims that have been brought. It was in the position of deciding who owns these claims, just the ownership. These underlying causes of action weren't tried in the bankruptcy court or the district court or tried before the Eighth Circuit. The Eighth Circuit just had to say, who's entitled to bring these claims? And they decided on the emotional distress claim that the plaintiff owned that claim. They didn't decide the merits. The merits and the viability of that claim was left to the circuit court. Now, the damages that they were claiming, the underlying damage that they're asking emotional distress for, was the sale of a house by the bank in which the plaintiff had no interest. She deeded away her interest, as the Eighth Circuit recognized, years before that, and the promise that she received was a personal property interest. And when she converted her case to a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, the trustee owned the letter, and the trustee owned the rights to that letter, and it was the trustee's property interest, not hers.
But what about Mr. Schoenbeck's response, though, that that relates to the property? He's claiming a right to the tort proceeds. And there's a difference. The trustee has the property interest, but she has the interest in the recovery for the tort.
But of course, the tort, the allegations, underlying allegation of the tort is that the bank sold this property without reserving any of her interest under the promise. The point is, not her interest anymore. And so we've cited numerous cases in our brief.
But I understood, though, that that was the whole allegation of the abuse of process, is that the conspiracy was to bring criminal charges against her so that she would do a warranty deed or deed over her interest, if any, to the house. Did I misread that?
Your Honor,
wasn't that the allegation?
Separate issues. The issue, the abuse of process claim was brought on and amended on well after the decision was on its way to the Eighth Circuit.
I understand, but wasn't that the underlying theory of the abuse of process? Was to, no matter whether you believed or not, whether your clients believed or not, that they had a, that she had an interest in it, that's what they were using the process for, was to get her to give a warranty deed for her, or quitclaim deed, or whatever they were after.
That was the plaintiff's position, yes. But as to the IIED claim, that relates to the sale of the home, as it relates to that specific issue. In this situation, you can't, well, let me give you an example. Mr. Schoenbeck, a friend of mine, know him for many years. I like my house. I sell it to him. A couple weeks after I sell it to him, an angry client burns down his house because he wants to hurt Mr. Schoenbeck. I'm devastated. I'm hurt by it. I'm upset because, one, I like the house, and most importantly, I'm very distressed about Mr. Schoenbeck's house being burned down. I don't have a property interest in his house. If you're going to claim emotional distress based on a property interest, you have to have a property interest. I don't have one. Can you imagine if you open up the floodgates and everybody who is distressed about something that happened to somebody else's property, which they had no interest in, was suddenly allowed to bring an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim? So the trial court certainly got that issue. I think the trial court got it right and figured that issue out without much doubt at all. Now, I'd like to talk about the closing argument allegation. And basically what that claim is that defense counsel committed misconduct by a statement that was made on the record. And first of all, I think it's clear that appellant's counsel didn't object to the statement at the time, never moved for a new trial. I think clearly under those circumstances, dealing with a misconduct allegation, that claim is waived. Beyond that, it's interesting that the only case that the appellant cites anywhere in its briefs regarding this particular issue is Schoen versus Luby, which is nothing but a misconduct case. So there's protestations that this just wasn't all about misconduct, it's some kind of a legal issue. Well, how come they're citing a case that's just all about misconduct and nothing else? And there's been a suggestion that statement wasn't taken out of context in the brief. I think it's important enough to address. And the statement that does appear in an appellant's brief is that Rita's taken thousands of dollars, and now she's come back for more money. $120,000, Mr. Schoenbeck says. How about our $200,000? I find it remarkable and unbelievable that she somehow suggests that she's the victim in this case, not the bank. Crime should not pay. Now, here's the context that should have been in there. Rita's contribution for restitution is very little. Give up the occupancy on the property you have no right to be on. go through the settlement agreement your attorney's already recommended and signed, deed back the pasture land, not much when you think, not much to meet the burden of that statute of the South Dakota policy under the circumstances. It was clearly a restitution argument. We're entitled to make that argument. In fact, there's no surprise that our primary defense to liability was restitution. The state's attorneys have an obligation under South Dakota law to help victims of crimes become whole. Both of the parties in their opening statements addressed restitution.
You're saying that restitution trumps abusive process?
No. Your Honor, our defense was that the requirements that Mr. Beck asked of Mrs. Fix were not onerous at all, were not abusive process. The jury disagreed with us, but we made that argument. We were certainly entitled to make that argument. And ultimately, the jury determined there were no damages. The jury also had that before them. The point is that there's no big surprise about restitution being raised as an issue in this case. As in both opening statements, Mr. Beck was cross-examined on the issue. Both the experts addressed it. Both the parties addressed it at closing. You have to be harmed before you get restitution. And the more you've been harmed, the more restitution you're entitled to. And our argument was that restitution isn't just getting somebody money, because we know that most criminal defendants don't have any money. We told the jury three times, we aren't asking for a dime from the plaintiff. The jury instructions didn't allow us to obtain any money from the plaintiff. We didn't have a counterclaim. The verdict form didn't indicate that there was any kind of a claim on our part against them. So clearly, I think that there's no merit to the suggestion that there was any sort of prejudice or anything that was untoward about the statement that was made once you consider it in the context of what happened. Next, I'd like to address the release issue. And that's one of the matters we raised on notice of review. There was an agreement between the parties that was entered into, a settlement agreement that was entered into. That agreement was not signed by the plaintiff until March 8th. It was executed in Mr. Summers' office at that time, and it was executed weeks after the February 21 hearing that the allegation is that the underlying facts, the facts underlying the abusive process, took place. And if you look at Mr. Summers' letter that he didn't send to Mr. Beck, the prosecutor, it's in the record as 295, Exhibit 107, it's pretty clear that Mr. Summers knew about all those allegations that were underlying this claim of abusive process. And I think that knowledge is imputed to his client, and he let his client sign that comprehensive release. And the trial court erred by not finding that that release had, in fact, released the bank from the abusive process claim.
Thank you, Mr. Damgard. Your time has expired. Mr. Schoenbeck, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Justices. If I might, let me start with that last issue. The release issue was decided by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's in the federal appellate court decision, and the claims were not released because of a couple of reasons. The holding company was not a party to the release. So one of the two defendants that the jury found liability against wasn't even a party to the release. And secondly, most importantly, the conspiracy was not completed until June, well after the release had been signed. And you cannot get prospective release for a tort, one that, in fact, you're in the middle of committing against somebody. And so they didn't have a release of those torts, those intentional torts, certainly the ones they were in the process of committing. If I might move to the other issues, the damage offset argument, you heard it read now in front of you. It was not about use restitution, about restitution in terms of what the state's attorney was doing on the liability side in an abusive process case. It was $200,000. She wants $120,000. We're out $200,000. It was a damage side argument that was made, and that was an offset claim, and that's not about restitution, and that's what the motion in limine specifically said. Look, don't let them do this. They're going to do it. And the trial judge was of the opinion that that would qualify as a restitution argument, and therefore we're five to get to decide somebody's right and somebody's wrong.
Was that issue preserved?
Well, it was by motion in limine, and the motion was denied. It was exactly on point. I mean, if you look at the motion in limine, it's verbatim.
So there's no need to make a motion for a new trial then because of the motion in limine?
I didn't believe there was a need for a motion for a new trial.
Justice, excuse me.
If I might go back to the first issue, because I think that if you can tell from how much time everybody spent on it, that's the one we're most concerned with. The criticism of the Judge Schreier's decision in Torres is misplaced. She was just saying, she was looking at the law, and she said, you know, after Marriott, they didn't do away with emotional distress, mental anguish. In fact, the Roth case says it several times. Roth wasn't about that issue, but her point was, people are trying to read Marriott for something that it isn't. And in fact, Chisholm is a South Dakota case. And Marriott has a couple of basic principles in it. It says that if you have a Section 4402, a midnight banking claim, that have to either, if you want to allege emotional distress, then for one of those you have to either meet negligent infliction or intentional infliction. And it references the Wright case. And Wright is talking about when all you've got is negligent conduct. In fact, the Wright language cited in Marriott says whose conduct was only negligent. There are policy reasons why we use a higher burden. If you go back and look at Wright, and if you look at Wright, which relies on Chisholm, they describe the body of the law is that if there's intentional acts, then you have to pay for all the damage you do. You don't get a higher burden. But if it's merely negligence, because it's a society, we don't want to have claims arise that are more amorphous, and the Marriott cites the three policy reasons from Wright, then we use a higher burden for those damages. This is an intentional tort claim. This is right amongst the list. It's consistent with the list set forth in Chisholm that have been the body of the law in South Dakota for a century. And I don't believe Marriott, it can be described as taking the bull by the horns. I think people are trying to make some kind of bull out of Marriott that it isn't. Marriott does not say we're going to reverse 100 years of jurisprudence. It's not that. Marriott says when you have one of these new kind of claims that arise under the midnight banking rule, there's no intentional conduct. Then you got to meet one of these other two torts. It's just a negligence cause of action, so it doesn't change it. Marriott is consistent with our body of law in South Dakota that we've had for decades. Justices, that's all I wanted to say for you today. I hope I get credit for finishing early. Thank you.
Nobody's ever chastised for quitting early here. Thank you. We'll be in recess until 11 o'clock.